This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town. Your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
Went to a nightclub back in the day. As a woman, were you harassed? Did you have your bum pinched, sleazy comments, maybe followed to the bathroom? And did you and your girlfriends have strategies to keep each other safe? Maybe you had code words, you never went to the toilet alone, pretended to have a boyfriend. Well, now for many of us, those days are behind us. However, your daughters may be starting to go to nightclubs. So has anything changed? Well, unfortunately, no. New research conducted locally shows that half of the women who go to clubs experience some kind of sexual harassment. So from government policy to nightclub owners, security guards, how can we make it possible to have a night out, to go dancing, without fearing for your safety and being harassed? Or will clubs always be sleazy? And also coming up this hour, if you have a cat and you live in a high rise, then you may need to consider high rise syndrome. It's something that affects cats.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Well, it might have been a while since you entered a nightclub, but if you take your mind back there, how safe did you feel? And was it just expected that, you know, someone would slap your bum, that someone might pinch you, that someone might lean up against you, follow you to the toilet, or just say something really sleazy and gross? And how much has it changed maybe over the decades since you've been to a nightclub? If you've got a young person in your house, it's schoolies now just around the corner. Lots of young people are heading to clubs into summer. Has it got any better? Unfortunately, no. New research conducted locally shows that half of the women who go to nightclubs experience some kind of sexual harassment. Kira Button is a PhD candidate in psychology at Deakin University and has conducted this research. Kira, is it just kind of expected that you'll be treated really unfairly and in a really sexually explicit manner in a nightclub?
Hi, Rochelle. Thank you so much for having me on. And unfortunately, that seems to be the case. We conducted some interviews with patrons around Geelong, over 200, and it seemed to come out, particularly for women, that, you know, they'd tell us, oh, even on the night, they've been groped, someone's kissed them. And what came across to me, particularly these really young girls, 18, 19, and I'd say, so sorry you've experienced that. And they'd almost shrug it off. That's just a part of the night out.
So when we talk about it happening and it being expected almost, which unfortunately was, I guess, in the 90s and early 2000s, when many of us that are in that Gen X bracket, I guess we thought the same thing. But what surprised me about this research is that in the decades that have passed, the conversations have changed, education, consent, awareness, standing up for yourself, a lot of things, what's accepted behaviour and what isn't, has changed. So the fact that this is still rife in nightclubs, that part surprised me.
Yeah, and it also surprised me when I started this research. I almost had a little bit of hope, maybe, that it wasn't as bad as I expected. But I often draw parallels. You think about if you go to a cafe, if you're in your uni lecture, you're right, it is a different time. There's protections in place for these spaces, but there seems to be something about nightclubs and bars where it just hasn't translated.
So what needs to change then? Is it about better training for the staff? Is it about women being able to report it to staff, knowing that something can happen? How do we change this type of behaviour, do you think?
I think there's no one solution. You mentioned reporting. One of our other papers that came out of this project was an online survey. You know, we had about 900 people across Australia, and we found reporting rates of sexual harassment in nightclubs was really low. Only about one third of people had reported to someone at the venue. And the reasons why particularly women weren't reporting was that they thought, well, it's normal in these spaces, and they didn't think venue staff would respond appropriately. So I think that speaks volumes about what needs to change. Security staff, you know, when they're approached, we hope that they would take things seriously, escalate it if needed.
1-300-222-774. If you have worked in a nightclub, if you work in a nightclub, what training and what procedures do you have in place? If a woman comes to the bar and says they don't feel safe or that somebody is grabbing them in an inappropriate way, do you have that training? Do you know what to do? And who do you call and how do you ensure that that woman is safe? 1-300-222-774. You can text as well, 0437-774-774. Kira Button is with you, a PhD candidate in psychology at Deakin University, who has conducted some research in the Geelong area and found that half of the women who were going out to nightclubs, almost half of them experience some kind of sexual harassment in some way. So how do we change that? How do we change that behaviour? And how do we change the reporting of it as well? This, Rish, I'm 26. I went to a few clubs in Bendigo as an 18-year-old and it was constant. Also, there was no Uber. So us girls had a buddy system to make sure that none of those, in particular older men harassing us, did anything worse than just taking a no for an answer. 1-300-222-774. I want to bring into this conversation Nicholas Taylor, who's a research fellow at the National Drug Research Institute for Curtin University, who's been behind this as well. Nicholas, listening to just how commonplace it is, the fact that this sort of behaviour has been happening for years, whether it be to us or now potentially to our daughters or to our sisters or to just our cousins, our girlfriends, whoever it may be, why is it that nothing has changed?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because essentially this is an unacceptable level of harm that's occurring in these venues. I would say one of the really interesting findings from our research is that it does depend on the venue and the venue characteristics that predict whether or not someone is likely to be targeted or the victim of sexual harassment. So, for example, we found that darker venues or venues with worse lighting were tended to have higher levels of sexual harassment. When you think about the interventions that people have tried in these spaces to reduce sexual harassment, usually think about things like bystander interventions or staff training. Mm. But there's very, very little to potentially no interventions or policy interventions anyway aimed at changing how the venue functions. How the venue is operated has a clear role in this space, and yet it's often treated as if it's immune from some level of interference.
So to change lighting in a nightclub kind of goes against the vibe a little bit, doesn't it? So is there a way to make a space safer? And I know dance floors in particular are like one of the main areas where women get harassed. Maybe there's this expectation that someone can sort of push their body up against yours or they can touch you inappropriately. And that would be very hard for others to be able to see.
Yeah, I will say it is relative. So we are comparing nightclubs to nightclubs. So the level of darkness, it can still be dark, but not. There are levels where, yes, you can't see anything. You can't see or control people pushing up against each other on some of these dance floors. Whereas there are other spaces which still have, you know, a similar environment, you know, that sort of context that you would expect when you go out to a nightclub, but not to the same degree. So, you know, when I say lighting, often people will think of like office lighting or something like that. But there are levels, you know, at that low level of lighting that we could consider, you know, talking about. In terms of dance floors, it is very much the context or what the venue puts forward as appropriate. You know, there is some research out there showing that the songs that play as well as how crowded spaces are allowed to be is also a strong predictor of whether or not sexual harassment will occur in these spaces. So there's definitely a tone that can be set in terms of how these venues are operated.
There's a text here that says, I worked at King Street in the late 80s and I take the details of cabs when we helped women who were in a vulnerable state to get home, so just to ensure that they were safe even once they left the venue. And over the years, we've seen some initiatives that have been taken. So there are signs in women's toilets, for example, that says if you feel unsafe, go to the bar and ask for Amanda or whoever it is, and there's all, you know, there are different names, for example, and that is the code that you give to the bar staff so that they will either help you get into a cab or into an Uber safely, or they'll just look after you in some way. Do initiatives like that help?
I mean, it's a great question. The issue is often these interventions are introduced with no intent or plan to assess them. So there's lots of surveys out there that ask whether or not people are aware of sexual assault or aware of how it occurs or something like that. But there's very little investment by the government in terms of evaluating whether or not these interventions they roll out actually reduce the occurrence of sexual assault. So to answer that question, we really need investment in this space and finding out more, because otherwise we're just introducing things that we think might work, but we really have no idea at the end of the day.
I mean, Annie's just sent a message saying, I just came back from the Queenscliff Music Festival. In the female toilets at the hotel there was a sign like that saying, if you feel uncomfortable or if you feel like you're being harassed, go to the bar and ask for, you know, ... and we'll help you in some particular way. Nicholas Taylor is with you, research fellow of the National Drug and Research Institute of Curtin University, who's been behind this study of women going to nightclubs, of which half felt like they were being harassed. I wonder how much now, as we get a little bit older, and if you're still wanting to go out and dance and go to nightclubs, whether or not women just change the spaces and the venues that they go to. For example, Nicholas, I would go to gay clubs with my gay male friends because I felt safe in those spaces. So do women just change where they go? And that's not a solution, right? It doesn't fix the problematic spaces, but at least women are going to safer clubs and being able to dance on the dance floor without having a feeling unsafe.
Yeah, I mean, Kira does have another fantastic paper looking at the consequences of sexual harm. So there are definitely strategies that women employ, including, you know, not going out at all or going to different spaces or, unfortunately, you know, dressing differently or changing their behaviour. These are responses. But you're right in that this is a reaction to what is preventable sexual harm. There's an initial incident which drives this sort of behaviour that we could do a lot more to prevent. You know, it shouldn't be an expectation of the victim of crime that they do that they have to change how they live their life in order to not be assaulted. We should really be looking at the factors around the perpetrators of crime and how we can intervene there to stop it from happening at all.
And just finally, Nicholas, I mean, it is, I agree with this text, it's really disheartening. It says, when I started going to more punk-style venues in the mid-90s, I actually saw way less disrespect for women. There's something about entitled men in mainstream nightclubs, especially in the early 90s and 2000s. I thought it would have changed. This is so disheartening. What can be done? We've spoken about lighting. We're speaking about women being able to report it and knowing that something will be done. Is it about better training, service of alcohol, more, I mean, you don't want security guards around, like, everywhere. What can create change, do you think?
I mean, it's a good question. And unfortunately, things like responsible service of alcohol have been tried and haven't really made a dent in this. I will say what we need more of is really shining a light on this issue. So if you do experience sexual assault and you report it to the venue, you should then also report it to the police. The venue should be following up and making a report to police. And if they don't, well, then that allows for some, you know, larger action where, you know, some of these venues that are being run in a more problematic way can actually be targeted. But it does require, unfortunately, that sort of two-level approach where people are reporting both to the venue and then to police, which, yeah, of course, can have a toll on victims.
And I guess reporting to the venue is important, even if you think it's not that big a deal or it's just in your head. So, for example, if you feel like you're being followed to the toilet, if you report the person and the next weekend another woman reports it, then you start to see a pattern of problematic behaviour, and then the venue knows who to look out for and can actually act and do something. So it's also about, I guess, just thinking, oh, well, doesn't really matter. I'm not sure if this was something. It's not going to hurt to report it. It might help.
Absolutely. I mean, definitely people should be trusting their intuition around this sort of thing. You know, one of the issues with venue staff training is these people have another job to do. They're often serving or cleaning up or, you know, trying to prevent violence. It's very hard for them to see everything that goes on the floor. So any communication that you have can only really help the staff operating the venue.
Nicholas, thank you. It's a shame nothing has changed, but hopefully at least women having the confidence to speak up and to speak out and to report it, hopefully that is changing. Nicholas Taylor, Research Fellow from the National Drug Research Institute at Curtin. And thanks to Kira Button, the PhD candidate in psychology at Deakin University, who conducted this research. Of course, if this has raised anything with you and you need to reach out to 1-800-RESPECT, you can. That number is 1-800-737-732, 1-800-737-732. My name's Rochelle. This is The Conversation Hour. Coming up in just a moment, we speak more and more about living in medium and high density apartments. So if you have a cat, you're going to want to listen to this.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So more and more of us are either living in medium or high density apartments, and the conversation is constant, even today, around building more high density. And we also know that for many of us, we have pets. So what does living in a high rise, and in particular cats, what do you need to think about? Because there is a thing that's called high-rise syndrome, and that actually impacts cats. Dr. Jessica Wild is from Lord Smith. She's the chief veterinarian there. Jessica, when we talk about high-rise syndrome in cats, what are we talking about?
Look, it's the number of factors which we need to take into account with high-rise syndrome. The first thing is around the enrichment within the environment of the home. So high-rise syndrome can definitely equate to the fact that our cats feel particularly frustrated if they're not receiving the right amount of enrichment, which can then lead to them potentially getting a little bit too curious for their own good and starting to explore things like open windows, balconies, etc., which then leads to some pretty serious injuries and significant events if they're curious. Curiosity means that they are falling from great heights.
If a cat is in a high rise, I mean, I'm presuming, given cats and what they can do, I mean, should cats ever be allowed out on balconies depending on how high up they are?
So, look, it just depends on the safety of your balcony and also depends a little bit on your cat. You know, some cats are particularly curious. Some cats are a little bit more lazy than others. But I think just making sure we're providing a really safe environment. So ensuring that any gaps on balconies are covered over with a mesh or with some form of protective layer. And if, for example, you have a balcony, for example, once again, you can net in those areas to provide a safe environment. Because it's still nice for a cat to be able to, if they can, get outdoors to experience the environment, the trees, etc. But we need to make sure it's really safe. Similar if you have children.
So can cats gauge how high up they are and whether or not they're safe? If they're, you know, they love to perch on balconies and perch on crazy little places, sit on the sides of things. Do they know and can they sense when it's too high?
Look, I think, once again, it's very cat dependent. We have some that are very intelligent and very switched on with their environments. And then we have others which, you know, haven't necessarily adapted to living within an inner city, or they don't necessarily have that mindset of, you know, being back out in the wild, I suppose, if we relate it to the fact of what they originally used to do. So I think it's around the fact that there is a level of understanding about where they are conceptually. And look, a lot of these times when they are falling, it's an accident. They're not necessarily jumping. They're slipping. You know, the cats, as graceful as they can be, still are trying to assess each environment as they go. And they do learn by feeling it out. So, you know, it could just be that in an effort to feel out that environment, they've slipped or they've overestimated or underestimated their height.
How common is this?
So, look, we are seeing quite a few cases a year, especially in the last few months. And we kind of, I suppose, related a little bit to the weather. So we obviously know during the colder weather, everyone has the doors closed, everyone has their windows closed because they're trying to keep the heat in. But as we start to see the weather heating up, I mean, in Melbourne, it's not been that warm yet, but it's going to start to get a lot warmer, is that that's when people have their doors open. That's when people have their windows open. So we tend to see a bit of an increase throughout this time of the year. And just even in the last month for us, we've seen 4 cases of cats falling from a distance. Now, that's been varying levels of injury, some been quite severe, and then some have been sort of more just a few bumps and scratches. So I would say that especially around these warmer weather months, we need to be extra cautious.
We know, we talk about cat runs, and as more and more councils are introducing cat curfews, whether or not cat curfews work and what those introductions look like. However, we're seeing cat runs placed in backyards. Are there different things that can be introduced to balconies, especially, and not even necessarily high density, but medium density as well? Are you seeing more cat runs, you know, cat enclosures, cat playgrounds type things that are built for apartments?
Yeah, absolutely. So the most common thing that I've seen is just simply netting in the balcony. So a lot of people will net in their backyards if they live in a house to prevent cats from getting out of their backyard. But you can just simply net in your balcony. You can also have cat runs that you can build onto your balconies as well. I've also seen some really creative stuff around creating tunnels and creating it. I mean, sometimes it's going to be the extent of your creativity. But if you're looking for something in a really simple solution, just simply netting in the balcony tends to be the easiest and the most achievable for most people.
Are cats okay living in apartments?
Yeah, absolutely. Once again, I think we need to not think necessarily of the size and the where of where they're living. We need to more think about the enrichment provided. I think that most of our animals, dogs and cats, are very adaptable to where they live, provided we're with every day interacting with them in a way which is going to keep them mentally stimulated. So for cats in apartments, once again, it's how much of that time are they having with active play, whether that be with you, whether that be through enrichment toys, just even simply creating shelving within your apartment that cats can climb up and down. They're all enrichment activities. Cats do tend to spend a lot of their time relaxing and sleeping, but at the same time, if you really make sure that the targeted periods of time, which is a couple of hours a day, they've got the ability to be able to engage their mind, you find that they'll really enjoy any environment that they're in living in.
I'm seeing more and more people walking their cats on leads, even down the beach the other day. I was like, is that a cat? It's becoming a thing. Like, at first, you'd be like, that's a bit strange. And now it's becoming the norm.
Look, I think the more and more we can integrate our animals into our lives, the more enjoyable it is for everyone. And I think that for a lot of times people underestimate how social cats can be and how much they, you know, their curiosity of being out and about is important to their well-being. Now, not every cat's going to love it. And, you know, I, for example, had a cat that the minute I put a harness on, pretended that he couldn't walk. But I think it's one of those things that if you start when they're quite young or if you really build them up slowly and make sure they feel nice and safe, I think there is a lot of cats that do enjoy going for a walk too.
This from Sue. I fully embrace pet ownership. I have two cats, but my heart cries for pets when their worlds just get smaller and smaller and the impacts that it can have on their well-being. However, another that said, I live in a high-rise in Hong Kong. My cats loved our apartment. Lots of windows and they would use the balcony and they never wanted to jump over the rails. Just finally, Dr. Jessica Wild is with you from Lord Smith, the chief veterinarian there. Should people, I guess, make some inquiries as to the best type of cat? We think about dogs and what's a good apartment dog, you know, what's a nice sleepy dog or what's an energetic dog. Do we need to think about cats and apartments in the same way we think about dogs?
Look, I think there's definitely a link and we definitely do know there is some more active cat breeds and definitely sized cats. You know, there is definitely obviously our large cats versus our small cats. But once again, I think it's all about how do you integrate them into your life and how do you engage the cat on an individual level? Because I think we could think about breeds, but we also know there's variation within breed. So I think it really comes down to how do you make sure you tailor your lifestyle and tailor that cat's environment to ensure that it's enriched on a day-to-day basis.
Let's have a chat to Caroline, who's in Seymour. Hi, Caroline.
Hello.
Hello. Do you walk your cat?
No, I wanted to tell you a little story about my grandmother.
Yeah.
She took up walking her cat with a harness and a lead, and she thought it was a great idea until it went horribly wrong. When she was out walking, her cat was threatened by a dog, and the cat's response to that was to scream up my grandmother and land on her head, and my grandmother ended up in the hospital with terrible facial and other body injuries as a result.
Oh, Caroline. Yep.
So just to all those people who are thinking about walking their cats, please keep an eye on what's around you because it can go horribly wrong.
And where you walk them. Caroline, how's your mum?
My grandmother, she passed away.
Oh,
but thank you for asking. It took her a long time to get over it and she never took her cat out on a lead again.
Oh, it would have been so stressful.
Yeah.
It was horrible. It was really, really bad.
Oh, yeah. Caroline, thank you. I mean, I guess that's the thing, Jess. Do cats, this sounds ridiculous, right, but do cats want to be walked on leads? Like dogs kind of do, but do cats?
I mean, I think that's, once again, it's the individual cat basis. So I think if they're demonstrating behaviours which is enjoyable, so they're remaining curious, they're remaining with relaxed body language, then I think you would continue to pursue that. And look, I think that's with walking any pet. You need to always be cautious about your surroundings. You know, small dogs, big dogs.
Cats and dogs on leads.
Cats and dogs. But, you know, we have obviously altercations, just even dog on dog. So I think it's always about being really aware of your surroundings. I think it's being understanding what your cat could do if it was, you know, because it is easy to pick up a cat, obviously, if a dog approaches, but cats can panic. And obviously the way in which they panic is they do use their claws during panic moments. But yeah, I think it's engaging with your particular cat and picking, I suppose, areas where you know there's a safety level. So it could be, for example, taking them for a walk just in a courtyard area or sort of a more closed off area to start with. If they're displaying signs where they're closed off, they're not wanting to walk, they've got tense body language all the time, then I'd be saying, look, it's probably not an activity that your cat's enjoying.
Will we ever see the day, I mean, growing up, we never had dog parks. We just had parks, right? And dogs would play and dogs, God forbid, would sleep outside back in, you know, the 80s and 90s.
Yes.
Will we ever see a time where we have cat parks?
Look, I think it'd be an interesting concept. We tend to find most cats don't love interacting with other cats. They tend to be
bizarre
social
creatures.
They are. But we love them because they come with their own unique personalities and they definitely make our lives interesting. But look, I think they tend to enjoy social interaction within their households normally. But we do tend to see that most cats are not incredibly fond of meeting new friends. There are some places places that are starting to do things like kitten kinder. So trying to, I suppose, integrate that social interaction from an early age. But look, I think it'd be interesting to see, but I think it's probably unlikely we're going to see cat parks in the very near future.
Good on you. Thank you. Dr. Jessica Wild from Lort Smith, Chief Veterinarian. So just take all of those things into consideration. Believe it or not, it is actually summer. I know today might be cold, but it's going to be 33 in a few days' time. So if you're in an apartment, especially if you're in a high-rise apartment and you have an indoor cat, just be careful. Just think about their safety. Coming up in just a moment, we know Melbourne is still buzzing about the opening of the new metro tunnel. We're going to look at whether its new nickname that was coined on our breakfast program with Bob and Charnel this morning, whether or not that will stick. And even though we're loving it and people are talking about it and taking photos of the new metro tunnel, will enough of us actually use it? What will get people out of their cars and onto the trains? That's next.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is the Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So we're all very excited about the new metro tunnel. Thousands of people have gone down to see it, take photos, ride it. Yesterday, the Conversation Hour, we did a live outside broadcast from the Town Hall station. It was fascinating. You can actually listen back to it. You can go to the ABC Listen app, or of course you can just jump onto the website that shows up there for the next week or so. But it was incredible to look at who was using the station and how we were using it and what the future of public transport really will look like, you know, whether in 10 years' time this is how our station will always look. One of the guests I had at the outside broadcast yesterday was Professor Graham Curry. He's a professor of engineering from Monash University, and he spoke about how we use it will be key and how do we get people out of cars and onto trains.
So this is sustainable infrastructure. Mm. It's actually what we should be building if we want to meet climate goals and to keep the city growing and the capacity of the city and the energy it has. Frankly, we've been on a path where we've been dealing with cars and they just fill up car parks and fill up roads. This is the future for us. We literally are going to be the size of London by 2050, and this infrastructure allows us to do it. I think we'll look back when we get to 2050 and wonder why we didn't do more. This is what the future should be. We should stop building these freeways that don't really solve the problem. We should be finding infrastructure and solutions that create economic outcomes for everybody, jobs, bring the community together. This is a very social project.
So that's Professor Graham Curry, who was just one of my guests yesterday from our Town Hall live broadcast. You can go back and have a listen. So as exciting and shiny and new as it is, how do we get more people using it fundamentally is the question. Hussein Dia is a Professor of Transport Technology and Sustainability at Swinburne University. Hussein, I mean, Professor Graham Curry is right. It's the future. It is more sustainable. However, we're still building roads and we still love our cars. So you would, I could imagine, agree with Professor Graham Curry.
100%, absolutely. And as he mentioned, I mean, this is the kind of sustainable future we want for our city. It is a massive step forward. And I totally agree as well. We should be doing more.
When you look at how it runs and how it operates, it was very smooth yesterday. However, trains were still only every 20 minutes. That's due to change. What is still putting people off? Is it frequency? Is it cost of, is it the ease of parking? What's the main barrier?
So frequency is definitely one of the main barriers. People don't take public transport. There is also the reliability and safety as well. When I look at these photos, all the new stations are very nicely lit, and there is security, etc. So all of these issues can help people. The Committee for Melbourne last month released a report where they surveyed a lot of people, and people were still relying more on their private vehicles and shying away from public transport. So we want this to change.
When Professor Graham Curry, he was talking about the sustainability of it, what makes something like the Metro Tunnel, what makes it sustainable?
So essentially, you're putting more people into the asset, if you like. So you're transporting more people. It is, electric in many cases. So it doesn't produce emissions. You don't see the congestion on the roads. So all of these issues contribute to making it more sustainable. And the idea is, as he mentioned, we want really to reduce people's reliance on private cars and make them use more of these shared modes of transport, whether it is buses, whether it is trams, or these new metro lines.
Where will we now sit globally, do you think? I mean, for me to watch it in operation for a couple of hours yesterday and to watch the flow and to watch how people used the space, lots of people, Hussein, were comparing it to Japan in particular, was the one that came up a lot. Where will we now sit globally, do you think?
I think it is a matter of also looking at these projects coming at different points of time. You have London and Japan. These are very, legacy systems that have been built for centuries. And this is, the scale as well is not as much. Even if we look at Sydney has a massive, more ambitious, metro scheme. But at the same time, it's going to cost maybe four times as much as Melbourne. So I would say the Melbourne Metro Tunnel is a massive step forward for the city. On its own, it's not going to be probably sufficient to deliver the sustainability outcomes we want. So we can think of it as the spine that is going to make people use public transport, but it needs to be supported by better buses, trams, and we need to think about the people who are living in the outer suburbs. I mean, once you get onto the rail system, you're fine and you can go at your destination easily. But the problem is many people find it difficult to get from their homes to the nearest train station. So this is where we need services to improve and support the new metro line.
Yeah, that's right. It can look all new and shiny and fabulous and space age in the heart of the city, but you get 10, 15, 20 Ks out of the CBD. Is there a connecting bus? Is there somewhere safe for you to wait? How long do you have to wait? Yeah. Just finally, I saw a lot of people, as I said, I was there for a couple of hours as we were broadcasting. I spoke to one of the head key designers from Hustle who was there joining us on the program. Accessibility was high on their list of priorities. I saw multiple wheelchair users. I saw a couple of people who had low vision and using walking canes, heaps of parents with prams. Accessibility felt good, but again, I wonder what your thoughts are on accessibility there. And then you might be able to get on the train at, say, Town Hall Station. But what happens when you get to Cranbourne at the other end? Can you get your wheelchair or your pram off at the other end?
So absolutely, and accessibility, cannot be an afterthought. It needs to be built in the system from the design stage, and you're absolutely right. I think it has been looked after with the new system. But again, someone traveling from Dandenong, for example, all the way to the city, we need to ensure that they have the proper accessibility as well.
Well, people from the regions use it. I mean, there's a taxi that says Victoria isn't just Melbourne and the suburbs. So how does it connect, and does it connect V-Line well? Does it connect people from regional Victoria well?
Okay, so I think it's going to have that add-on effect for everyone, because essentially it is going to relieve a lot of stress from the current network, especially in February, where some of these three lines are going to go through the tunnel exclusively. That's going to free a lot of capacity, is going to make access better, it's going to increase frequency, etc. And I think people in the regions as well, when they travel, of course, to Melbourne, they're going to feel the benefits as well.
Always good to get your thoughts on this. Thank you, Hussein Dia, Professor of Transport Technology and Sustainability at Swinburne University. Well, you may have heard on our breakfast program this morning with Bob and Charnel. They had decided to, try and give the Metro Tunnel a nickname. Some really great ideas were thrown around, all sorts of different ideas. It started with Munnel, but anyhow, the winner in the end was Mutt.
I think it should be short and sharp. I think it should be called the Mutt.
Yeah, the Mutt.
The Melbourne Underground Tunnel.
The Mutt.
You're really liking the Mutt.
The Mutt is a bit of a grower for me.
Okay, yeah. All
the
right.
Winner, and by 42% have the vote in total, 42%, the Mutt, the Melbourne Underground Tunnel, the Mutt.
So will you ever call the Metro Tunnel the Mutt? I think it's the perfect nickname. I could imagine saying, I'm jumping on the Mutt, I'm stuck on the Mutt, let's, you know, meet you at the Mutt. So what makes a title stick, and is this one that will hold? What do you think? 1-300-222-774. A text that says no, not the Munnel and not Mutt either. I, however, I'm with Bob. I think the Mutt is an absolute winner. Rolly Sussex is a professor, an emeritus professor of applied language studies at the University of Queensland. I love Mutt, Rolly. What do you think?
It's pretty good. I mean, I was born in Melbourne, and so I feel quite attached to Mutt. But the other thing is that Australians love to be a bit disrespectful. And, you know, having a tunnel which you call a Mutt, and overseas visitors would say, what? You know, and you say, well, yes, it's our name for our tunnel. We have a kind of right to be disrespectful and funny, and it's pretty good. But I started thinking about tunnels. You know, the one under the channel between Britain and France is called the Channel, so it gives you Munnel, which you've already got.
Yeah, people didn't like Munnel.
No, it doesn't feel right. I did think a little bit about Alice in Wonderland, because she goes down the rabbit hole. So you could call the tunnel the rabbit hole, possibly.
I like that. We're doing the breakfast show all over again. No, I think we've settled on Mutt, but what I like about it is that it's short and sharp. It's kind of, it has an edge to it when you say it as well. And it can be, you know, you can love it. Like there's, when you think about a mutt, you know, if you think about a mongrel dog, like, oh, it's kind of a little bit lovable. Or when you're hating on it, you can hate on it as well.
That's right. It allows for any emotion to be attached, depending on your current state of mind. So I think that Mutt is actually pretty good. But Rabbit Hole was not bad. I was thinking about Burrow and things like that. Then I thought about various other initialisms and acronyms. Now, in San Francisco, they've got the BART, which is the Bay Area Rail Transport, I think. There's the MTA in Boston. In Paris, they've got the Metro, which is just the Chemin de Fer Métropolitain, meaning a metropolitan railway. And the Metro has now become virtually universal. I did think about TARDIS, which gets you magically from A to B.
Absolutely.
It's probably been copyrighted by the BBC, I'm afraid. And then I thought of Thomas the Tank Engine. Could you call it the Fat Controller, perhaps? But except that one isn't meant to be using words like that in a disrespectful way. What else inhabits a dark, tunnelly sort of place? A troll.
Oh, yes. So
you might call it the troll.
What makes it stick? Does it need to just... Is it the general public that will pick it up and run with it, and then as a result it becomes somewhat unofficially official?
Yeah, I think it is usage that does it. I mean, for example, I was born in Melbourne in 1945, and I went to the VFA, as it then was, at the MCG. But the MCG is now the G, and anyone who lives in Melbourne calls it the G, and we know what it is. And if you don't call it the G, you mark yourself as an out-of-state person. But I do have one serious suggestion, which I think is a really good one. In Berlin, they've got something called the S-Bahn, and Bahn, B-A-H-N, means a railway. And in Adelaide, they've got the O-Bahn, which is a sort of a busway. And in Melbourne, you call Melbourne Nam.
Mm-hmm.
Why couldn't you have the Nam-Bahn?
You've really thought about this, haven't you?
I have, over avocado for breakfast, and I had a little moment of epiphany. Nambahn is perhaps a little bit long. Mutt is short. It's just one syllable, and one syllable usually wins.
And looking at it too,
has a kind of gravitas, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. But also too, because it's short and sharp. I mean, people are texting it in now saying, yep, absolutely, Mutt, love it, I'd use it. And also just being three letters, it looks good and short and sharp. And I guess... Do we always want a nickname for things like this, that we never actually go with just what it's called. Is that an Australian thing to find a nickname?
It's universal. Every language I've ever looked at, and I've checked out more than 40, has some form of nicknames or diminutives, which are affectionate things. So that, for example, Brisbane is called Brizzy or Brizzo, or sometimes Briz Vegas. And I have on my my computer 6,273 of these as of this morning. So that my name is Roland, but I'm called Roly. And if you go to Bundaberg, that's Bundy. If you go to Rockhampton, that's Rocky, except that in Perth, Rockingham is Rocco. But we do it all the time. And once you've got a diminutive or a nickname that we like, remember Jezelenko was Jezza, footballers, we use them all the time. And it's a way of indicating we belong to these people and they're part of our group of talking, and it's sort of a friendly code between friends.
Absolutely. And, so we love
I reckon,
a nickname.
I reckon Matt's got the legs.
And adding an O to the end of someone's title, that was a big thing growing up in the Valley. Roly, thank you. Roly Sussex, Professor of Emeritus, apologies, Professor of Applied Language Studies at the University of Queensland. Whether or not we think Mutt will stick, it was what was defined, it was what was come up with on our breakfast program this morning as the nickname for the Metro Tunnel. This, I love Mutt, but can it be Melbourne Underground Train? All tunnels are underground. It seems a little bit unnecessary. That's from Dave in Geelong. Joe's in Brunswick. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Rish. This has been a fascinating topic for me. I like the actual line. If you look at it on a map, it's just sort of like a squiggly line. And I think that our respect to Mr. Squiggle could come in and call it the Squiggle.
Do you think? I just think Mutt will stick. I mean, it's short and it's sharp, and I think people will hook onto it. You don't think it's going to work, Joe?
Oh, look, you know, so many things will work. I just thought, you know, in terms of most Australians of a certain age or over a certain age loved Mr. Squiggle, and it was a squiggly line down from Arden down the centre, and then they curve at the other end, at either of the ends. So,
I love Mr. Squiggle. There's a big exhibition of him on at the moment. Have you been on the new Metro Tunnel yet, Joe?
I wasn't able to come down and see you yesterday morning, unfortunately, but I will be travelling because I'm a train nerd as well.
Are you?
Many years ago, I was doing a Bachelor of Business in Transport because I wanted to run the public transport system, but I was too stupid with accounting.
It's so bizarre to experience the Metro Tunnel, and when you first walk in you can't figure out what's so different, and then the fact that the train, it's that you can't see or hear the trains and you can't feel that big gush of wind, and the trains are behind black frosted glass, you know, and you can't see the railway lines, you can't see the tracks, and it's just all so different. And the fact that you are so deep underground is something that, I don't know, you sort of can't let your brain go there a little too much. Good on you, Joe. Great to hear from you. 1-300-222-774. If you think Mutt will stick, that's what made it to the top of the list on our breakfast program this morning. Rish, it says City Loop is still just known as the Loop, but lots of people saying, yeah, I think it's good. This Mutt isn't good because it actually means an unintelligent pooch. That's from Alison. But see, I kind of liked the dog association, that sort of Mutt or that mongrel part of it. Lots of people talking about our story that we did at the beginning of the program as well, which is whether or not young women feel safe at nightclubs. If you went out to clubs maybe in the 90s or early 2000s, was it just expected? And did you just expect to be harassed in some way, either your bum pinched or followed to the toilet? It turns out now, after some research that's been done in Geelong, that it hasn't changed, that nothing has changed. Half of the women who were surveyed still get harassed in some way. So, you know, do we need better lighting at nightclubs? And not talking bright lights, but, you know, just safer lighting. Do staff need better training? Should women be reporting it more so that problematic people and repeat offenders actually get known and get banned from places or get reported to the police? But just one of the texts on this, such an important conversation. This is about men respecting women and men pulling up other men on their unacceptable behaviour as well. Neil's in Ballarat. Neil? Mutt? Did Bob and Chanel, are they onto something? Is mutt going to stick?
No.
Why not?
I think there's another name for it.
Yeah.
The amount of money they spend on it, they should call it the Detro Tunnel.
Yeah, well, Blowhole, I think, was one of the names that was given to it this morning.
Yeah.
Have you been on it yet, Neil?
No, I haven't. I haven't had a chance yet.
And from Ballarat, I wonder how easy it will be for you to be able to jump onto it.
Don't know. I actually don't travel on the trains much.
Why is that?
I drive everywhere.
You drive?
Yeah.
What will get you out of your car and onto the trains?
Nothing. I carry tools with me every day. Okay. I'm a subcontract carpenter.
Yeah, that makes it a little tricky. Good on you. Thank you. Good to hear from you. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care and we'll speak to you soon.